ID, the future. A podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
What kind of problem does information pose to materialistic theories of the origin of life or of the evolution of new species? And to what extent will evolutionary theorists go to deny that it poses a problem? Hello, I'm Tom Gilson, and today on ID the Future, we hear a conversation between Dr. James Tuer, synthetic chemist from Rice University, speaking with Dr. William Dembski, holder of multiple advanced degrees, on the information problem in life. This is the first part of a two-part conversation we're going to present to you, used by permission, originally presented at Dr. Tuer's Science and Faith podcast.
Let me introduce my guest today. Bill Dembski is a mathematician, philosopher, and theologian. Bill completed an undergraduate degree in psychology in 1981 at the University of Illinois at Chicago, a master's degree in statistics in 83 at the University of Illinois at Chicago, a master's degree in mathematics in 1985 at the University of Chicago, a master's degree in philosophy in 1993 at the University of Illinois at Chicago, and then he completed two PhDs, one in mathematics in 1988 at the University of Chicago, and a PhD in philosophy in 1996 at the University of Illinois at Chicago. And if this wasn't sufficient, he's got also a Master of Divinity in Theology in 1996 from Princeton Theological Seminary. Bill has worked at several places, including the Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture. He was a Philip E. Johnson Research Professor of Science and Culture at Southern Evangelical Seminary in Matthews, North Carolina. And he's written a bunch of books and a bunch of papers. I mean, a lot of papers. I was looking through this list of papers where he's done a lot on information theory. He's written several books on the topic. No Free Lunch, Why Specified Complexity Cannot Be Purchased Without Intelligence. The Design Inference, Eliminating Chance Through Small Probabilities. The Design Revolution, Answering the Toughest Questions About Intelligent Design. And also The Design of Life, Discovering Signs of Intelligence in Biological Systems. And he also wrote a book called Being as Communion. Tell me, how long have you been working in this area of information theory?
If you think of information theory as a branch of probability, it would go even back to my doctoral dissertation at the University of Chicago in 88. But I think specifically on how these ideas impact origin of life, subsequent development of life, I would say probably around 1990, 91, I wrote a paper called Randomness by Design, where a lot of these sorts of ideas that I played with in subsequent years were in embryo form there.
Okay. I've learned a couple of things as I prepared for this by watching some of your videos and reading some of your thoughts. And it's what is information? And what you've listed, you had a slide that says information is the realization of one possibility to the exclusion of others within a reference class of possibilities. Information is measured via probabilities. The smaller the probability, the greater the information.
Right.
And on that for us.
What does that mean? I mean, basically for information to happen, there has to be a reduction of possibilities. If I say it's raining outside or it's not raining outside, I haven't given you any information. I've not reduced any possibilities. If I tell you it's raining outside, then I've excluded it's not raining outside. So that at its most general is what information is. I mean, you can think of it in other contexts. It comes up all over the place. Poker hands. If I tell you a royal flush, you know, I've limited that to four possible hands out of almost 2.6 million possible hands in poker. So it's always, you've got to exclude things and, you know, narrow down on one thing, exclude other things. Now, I think for most people, they think of information in digital terms. So it's like, I mean, you deal with DNA and proteins. And so often what you have is a finite number of distinguishable elements, repeatable elements that are then arranged linearly. Now, in practice, that's how we identify information You know, so with the poker hands, I could, you know, represent them in bit strings, you know, so then that's a way of conveniently organizing information for computational purposes. But at its most general, it is a reduction of possibilities. And I can just give you another example. For about the last 10 years, I've been involved in business. And one of the things I do to earn money is generate leads. Now, what's a lead? I may want to give a school somebody who's likely to enroll in their program. Now, if I take somebody off the street, you know, it's very unlikely that that person is going to want to enroll at some school. But if I can get them to a website where they are, they got there by an organic search, where they're asking, you know, doing their keyword search in terms of that program, then they're psychologically primed. I've reduced the number of people and I've gotten a subpopulation that's much more likely to enroll than the general population. So it's that reduction. Why am I getting money? It's because of the information I am giving the schools. I'm giving them, it's not that there's going to be a guaranteed enrollment, but it's a higher probability of enrollment. So information is always this narrowing down. And the more you narrow down, the more information you're given. And then, you know, you can put it in terms of just sheer possibilities, just counting them. But in practice, what we do is we look at probabilities. So when I was generating leads for schools, they would like to see about a 2% enrollment rate on the leads that I gave them. And so that's how it works, and it works across the board. But you can always represent information digitally. So in terms of these, you know, alphanumeric character strings linearly arranged, and then we can do computation with them. So that's a whole other aspect to it.
So now when you think about information in DNA, this can go to, when you have DNA or you have now RNA, this can be translated to a protein. Any three bases can be a codon, but right, just having a random set of codons is not the type of information, it was my impression, not the type of information that's going to get you what you need to have construction of an enzyme that's going to build something that's relevant to life. I've heard this term Shannon information versus specified complexity. Shannon information is based off of this work from Shannon in the 1940s, where he was able to extract information from randomness. And I think it was Leslie Orgel even used the term, the famous origin of life researcher from the 20th century used the term specified complexity, that you need something that's much more advanced than just Shannon-like information if you're going to have life. So I've just thrown out a bunch of terms here, sure, that you're an expert in and I'm not, and I want you to bring this home for me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Shannon was back in the late 40s. He was trying to understand communication channels and how do you move information from one place to another across a channel. And the idea there was, I mean, he wasn't concerned with what the message is that you're moving. I mean, it was just any bit string, and he was looking mainly at bits, you know, was as good as any other. So there was, and in fact, he made it very clear that he wasn't concerned about the semantics of the information. I mean, what was of concern for him is if there was a sequence of bits at one end of the channel, it needed to get reliably to the other end of the channel. And so then other things that would come up are noise on the channel and error correcting codes and all of that. So there's a whole technology that was built on top of it. But it's very much in line with what we just said. I mean, basically you have this whole range of possible things that you could be sending, and then which are the interesting ones? And, you know, if we look at it in the biological context, well, what are the interesting strings of DNA? Well, it's those that code for functional proteins. The vast majority are going to be gibberish. They're not going to code for anything. And likewise, the vast majority of bit strings are not going to be an ASCII code spelling out some meaningful English text. They're going to be gibberish. They're going to not serve any purpose. And so the specification always refers to some sort of meaningful or independent pattern that we wouldn't expect on the basis of chance. So it's that's where the idea of specification comes in. And then that needs to be cashed out in various ways, because You know, in many human contexts, the patterns are imposed externally. So, you know, I might put a target on a wall and start shooting an arrow at it. And if I keep hitting the target, you know, I'm going to say, well, that's, I'm the person who's shooting that arrow must be an experienced archer. You know, so it's happening by design rather than chance. But then I think in the biological context, these specifications are internally given. It's the functional requirements, the functionality that you're getting out of these systems. That's what, you know, that things are alive rather than dead. And it's, there are a lot more ways to be dead than to be alive. And so that's why, again, you have that reduction. You know, it's like, well, what are the ways of being alive? And they're much fewer, and those end up being specified.
Okay, so you know, one of the things that I think that I learned by just studying some of your work was that people have done Darwinian searches. So because you want to take something that may have happened over millions of years and reduce that down to a time frame where we live so that I can publish a paper in the next year or two on this topic, I have to do this in silico. I have to do this in a computer. So you do Darwinian searches, but they are infused with information because people have done what they've called Darwinian searches, and they show that things can improve, that you'll get improvement, which is different than new speciations, but still they get these improvements. But these are filled with information, and I think you've referred to it as hyper heuristics, where you're putting information on top of information, and then you're never helping the problem. You're just either keeping it equivalent or making the problem harder as a result.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is a very common problem. And I was actually just reading a book by a friend of mine, Eric Larson, on the myth of artificial intelligence. And so he's looking at, for instance, machine learning, and that's how with machine learning, you always have to bias the search. Bias is not in the sense of being bigoted. It's that you're trying to solve a problem. And so you have to arrange the whole machine learning context in a way that it gets to that solution. Okay, so there's a solution. Well, that's a specification, you know, and so, but by biasing it in one way, you don't allow it to solve other problems. And that's the issue when you have, for instance, evolutionary computing, the sorts of things you're referring to, where you set up maybe a fitness landscape, which gets you to a certain place. But by getting you there, you don't go to other places. But then what does improvement there mean? What does it mean to have a specification? I mean, in these evolutionary computing contexts, you're trying to solve a problem. It's a well-defined problem. And then there is this target out that you're trying to reach. It might be that you're trying to do a crooked wire genetic antenna. You know, so you're trying to get a little antenna that radiates across a hemisphere. So you run an algorithm and you get there, but you've set up the optimization. You've set it all up so that it will evolve there. If it evolves there, it's not going to evolve elsewhere. So it's probably the best, you know, where this clicked with me years back. And in a sense, I reinvented the no free lunch theorems because I was reading Richard Dawkins. I mean, Dawkins has been incredibly fecund for me. I mean, fruitful in reading him because I think his mistakes are so insightful in some ways. But he has an example in which he will evolve a target phrase. He thinks it is like a weasel, taken from Shakespeare. And he'll start with some random characters, but then as you're getting closer to that target sequence by some sort of metric, it's like a Hamming metric, he'll be able to evolve there in about 43 steps. Whereas if you were just randomly generating sequences, it would take about 10 to the 40 steps on average. I mean, you can do these waiting times, you know, so how long would it take to get there? And so he gets there very quickly, but it's because he's biased the algorithm. And he could have set up the fitness landscape instead of going for that target phrase, any other phrase. And it could have been a random phrase. And then it would have gone there. So why is it that the search, yes, the search worked well. It was an evolutionary search, but how did you get the search that got you to that target? And that's really been the thrust of my work with Bob Marks, that it's not the search that, you know, we shouldn't be mystified that the search is getting us this information. It's how did we get the search that gets us the information? And, you know, I think that's where Dawkins does this sleight of hand. and many people in this evolutionary computing business, as they try to use evolutionary processes to try to justify biological evolution, basically they slip in this information and they don't go back a step further and say, okay, where did the search come from that allowed us to get to this information? And so we can actually, what we've done is we've computed what the information requirement is when you look at a space of searches. You know, so it's you basically what you do is, instead of the original search, now you're searching a space of searches, and the problem just gets more difficult. So this is the whole issue of this conservation of information, that you, as you try to account for information, the information problem either stays the same, that would be conservation, or it gets worse. And you just, basically what it means is that as you try to uncover a source of information, there's more and more information that you need to get. Actually, John von Neumann made a similar argument in the 1940s, where it was basically, the idea was, if you have a self-replicating machine, there's got to be more information in the machine than in the product. And so you can't really get a self-replicating machine where it's basically all self-accounted for. So these ideas have some history, but it's I think what the results that I've come up with Bob Marx and some of his students, it seems to me, really nail things down, that you haven't solved the information problem. All you're doing is displacing it. You're sending it back further, which then raises the question, where is the ultimate source of information? That's exactly what evolution, materialistic evolutionists don't want, because what they want to do is explain complexity from simplicity. They want some sort of primordial simplicity and then get it all by this magical process of evolution. And what we're saying is that information is basically a form of accounting. And when you do the accounting, the problem always gets worse as you go back. So you haven't really explained anything. You've just moved the problem around. It's like a little shell game. You know, and I think for me, it's very, very compelling. But, you know, these ideas, it seems, have not gotten as much play as they should.
Yeah, this is interesting in the context in which I think a lot about, which is origin of life. And my argument has always been, molecules don't care about life. Organisms care about life. Molecules don't care. They don't know how to move toward life. They have never been shown to move toward life. There's no interest in moving toward life. They have no brain, no desire to move toward life. And so when you set up a target and you say, here is a cell, I want you to move toward that cell, you've already heavily biased the system. And now what you're saying is, the information that I input to say, I want you to make this cell, that's an enormous amount of information that I've put in there. And I've heavily biased this system to try to go toward that, when it, in its own view, it would have no desire to go toward that than to go in the other direction.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, everything from the field of evolutionary computing, computational intelligence, underwrites that. I mean, that you have to, that it is the computer programmer, the designer, that's inputting all this information. So there was a colleague of Bob Marx who would call himself a penalty function artist, because in order to make these algorithms work, you know, penalties are kind of the flip side of fitness. So you try to increase fitness or you try to minimize the penalties, but it's the same concept. And so he was finding that, you know, there was, and this is, I think, universally, that the designer, the programmer, has to put in all this information. When you talk to the evolutionary biologists, the materialistic ones, however, it's as though once you get natural selection working, it's just magic. So, you know, to your point, well, once you can get some little simple replicator, you know, just some string of some ribozyme, it's all going to just bootstrap. It's all just going to run, and the information will magically materialize. And finally, presto changer, you're going to have a cell. And it's just nonsense. But you know, it's the evolutionists in this case that are the mystery mongers. You know, I think all the real science here is on our side.
Yeah, well, you know, I've given them, I say, okay, you can't get the ribozyme because you can't make the sugar, that so that you can't make the ribose. If you had the ribose, you can't hook these together because you get 2-5 linkages, you get 3-5 linkages, and your yields are so low. But anyway, I'll give you the ribozyme. I'll not just give you the ribozyme. I'll give you all the amino acids that you want in homochiral form. I'll give you all the sugars that you want in homochiral form. I'll even hook them together for you and any sequence that you want. So you can have whatever information you want. Get the information from a living cell. And now all I'm asking you to do is take all those components, which I just took out of a living cell. I deconstructed it and took all these pieces and I put them before you in your pristine laboratory, not in a cave, not under a rock. Now go ahead and assemble a cell that's going to have life. Nobody would ever say that they could assemble a cell from that. And so when they come with these little things that you have a ribozyme and then you get a cell, it's kind of silly. I mean, people have made YouTube videos that, okay, now that you have a ribozyme and you have these components, now all you need is millions of years and you'll have a cell. Where do you get that? If you can't do it in your lab, how do these things construct? There's a huge amount of information, even in from the components to the full assembly, because they have no idea that they want to go toward the full assembly. There's no desire to do this. Molecules have no desire to move toward life.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And also, I mean, the information problem, I think often the neo-Darwinist wants to put it in terms of, well, it's all in the genetics, you know, that we've got the full body plan. And it's not just in the genetics, there's the epigenetics, there's all sorts of spatial relationships in these components which have to be there to have a functioning cell. So the information problem is immense, but and I think they think that somehow, I mean, I've heard it, you know, to your point just now, people coming back and saying in hushed tones, well, natural selection is just smarter than us, you know? Natural selection can do it, but we can't, you know? And it's almost, you know, substitute natural selection for God, you know? And it's just and then we are the crazy ones because we believe in God, the real God, you know, who actually has the capacity to do all of this.
Yeah.
And, you know, the creative power of natural selection, the evidence for it is nil.
Indeed. Their selector is their intelligent designer. They are the ones who are grabbing the concept of intelligent design and putting it upon their selector, because a selector has to be extremely complex, generally more complex than the thing that it's selecting. So what about this thought that some have put forth that, okay, well, you have a room, 12 people are in that room, and they all have different birthdays. The probability of having those 12 different birthdays from those 12 people in that room, I mean, there's a very, very small probability that you'll ever see that, but you have it. And therefore, this is somehow solving the problem, the information problem that we need toward life. Yeah. Are you familiar with these arguments?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's just that these highly, highly improbable things happen all the time. And so we shouldn't be surprised if we've got something. But let me turn that birthday analogy around. What happens if all those people, those 12 people in the room, all have the same birthday? It all happens to be March 29th, 2012. That happened by chance? I mean, it's the same improbability. It's one in 365 to the 12th power, right? So did that happen by chance? I would say if you're going to argue by parity of reasoning, one is as improbable as the other. So sure, you know, those 12 people, they all had the same birthday. Nothing to see here, you know, nothing to explain. I'd say you're terribly naive, you know. So what is the difference there? Well, in one case, there's a specification. I mean, you can put it in terms of Kolmogorov complexity, that it's much, there's a much more compressed way of saying this, you know. Everyone has birthday March 29th versus person one had birthday this, person two this, person three this, person four that. That takes a much longer specification. So these compact specifications, those are the ones that require explanation. But yeah, I mean, this argument, I've seen it over and over, and it's as though, you know, I wrote my book, The Design Inference, which was published with Cambridge University Press, you know, so not a vanity press. And, you know, I made that point, you know, that it's not just brute improbability, it's the improbability when it matches up with a pattern specification. That's when things require explanation. And it's as though, you know, I might just not as well have written the book. You know, it's like, oh, we'll just ignore the guy. What can he know? And then they just go off. I mean, there's just this vast ignorance and arrogance, it seems, you know, that they can just ignore this and get away with it.
Yeah, well, I mean, you've got full agreement with me. I mean, people will say, well, Tor, why don't you just publish in Origin of Life and let these ideas be known? Listen, people have already shared these views. Clement Riker just shared these views in Nature Communications 2 years ago, where he said every time you have too much input, you have operator input, you're using pure chemicals, and all of these problems he maps out. They totally disregard his paper. And they say, well, Tor, you shouldn't make your YouTube videos because just write a paper. People ignore it. People ignore it. So you can point these things out. And my argument is, when you have stepped into your laboratory, you have influenced that experiment. Every time you choose a chemical off the shelf, you influence that experiment. Even the groups that say that they're trying to take the human influence out, you look at their setups and they've got all of these tubings coming in, hooked up to a computer at precise times, and everything is extremely well mapped out. And there's all this human input here, which is sort of like your concept of hyper heuristics, where you're putting in all of this input, which makes the probability of this it's working against you.
So you don't think that accurately captures prebiotic conditions, what's going on?
No, it's hard for me to imagine that on an early Earth. It's really
all the intelligences. You know, that's okay. Panspermia is okay. Directed panspermia, where space aliens come and they do their experiments and they create life on Earth.
You know, and then when you finally get them in a corner, they'll say, well, we've seen these things in outer space. They say, okay, it's the same periodic table. We're talking about origin of first life. Whether you're in outer space, anywhere in this universe, our periodic table is the same. You don't want to explain it on this planet, explain it in space. Explain it on some other planet. Anything you want to pull together, it actually gets harder when you try to pull these molecules together when you're out in space and not confined to the individual flask of the planet Earth.
Earth is a pretty hospitable place, you know, by comparison with the rest of the universe, as far as we know. So,
yes. Know. Yes. I mean, yeah, what happens in space to molecules is they're constantly being bashed apart at the rate that things are traveling. So
that was Dr. James Tor, holder of multiple awards in his field of synthetic chemistry, speaking with Dr. William Dembski on the problem that information poses in theories of a naturalistic origin of life and naturalistic evolution. For the rest of their conversation, tune in to ID the Future. And while you're at it, subscribe to ID the Future on your podcast app of choice. While you're there, it would be a great favor to us if you would give ID the Future a 5-star rating. It really helps us get the word out about intelligent design. Until next time, I'm Tom Gilson for ID the Future. Thank you for listening.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.